All right, welcome back to the Art of Commercial Real Estate, sponsored by First National Realty Partners. As always, we're joined today by the managing principals and co-founders of FNRP, that being Anthony Grasso and Chris Palermo. And Anthony, I'm going to start with you because we got a great topic on hand today. We want to touch on conducting a thorough due diligence when you go under contract for a property. So having said that, start us off. You know, from the beginning phase, you have a property, right? You've identified the one that you think you want to go after and you put a bid in. Walk me through what the process looks like. What's your mindset at this stage in the game right now?
It's a good question. I might cover a couple of questions you're going to have going forward in this statement. But the main issue with acquiring commercial real estate is that when you're making offers, a lot of times you're using incomplete or impartial information. You don't have the whole story. You're being supplied a lot of times information from a seller or a broker or an intermediary who represents a seller. And there's really no way to verify 100% of that information without conducting thorough due diligence. So that in there's your conflict right there. It's how do you make a bid, you have a set of numbers, and then ultimately you find out something's changed. So that's kind of what the dilemma is. And that's what makes conducting thorough due diligence and doing it the right way so important. Because there's so many little things inside of this period that can destroy a deal and could ruin you, you know, years down the line. So you have to conduct thorough due diligence and you have to have that, you know, that idea that you're going to be thorough and you're going to get the correct information, which always isn't the information that you're bidding on when you first start throwing bids out.
Yeah, and just to add on that point, the reason why is very simple. The broker that's the broker who's creating the OM represents the seller in the deal. So in order to have the property become more marketable, a lot of times these brokers will, you know, leave leases out, fudge numbers a little bit, and it's our job as the buyer to make sure that we're buying the income stream that we originally signed up for, and a lot of times, more than not, that's not the case. So there's always that, you know, conflict, which is,
which needs to be rectified. Exactly. Yeah, which absolutely has to be rectified, because if you're somebody who's making a bid and the information is not complete, it's inaccurate, something was misrepresented, somebody has to pay for that. And you can try to do a lot of the lion's share of the due diligence before you go to contract, but ultimately, in our deal cycle, typically, we might get 90% of the story, and then we get the other 10%. The closer you can get to 100% before making your offer, the better. But in the commercial real estate process, as a lot of people know, that always isn't the case.
And you have to be on guard because, you know, a lot of times, you know, a lot of these brokers, they're very eager to sell these deals, and certain times what is represented is not reality. The way you get there is by conducting your due diligence.
Yeah, and I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but understand something. A lot of times you're making a bid based off a commission salesman making his commission. The way he feeds his family is by getting a deal done. So a lot of these guys, they put a bunch of BS numbers in, they omit material information, and you're left with an incomplete picture. So you're leaving up your purchase and acquisition based on to what some commission salesman is putting into a document. So you have to keep that in mind at all times.
So basically, when you guys even put in your first offer, you're kind of doing it with a grain of salt, right? With the understanding that this offer, it's based on this information, but the information may not be accurate, or we may find new information. Is that, am I hearing that right?
Yeah, well, you have to start somewhere. So you have to take what they provide as it being accurate, and based on what you find, you always work backwards. So, of course.
Yeah, and what Chris and I like to do is we like to pretend, and we know it's not the case, but we like to pretend that we're getting the gospel. When they send us the NOI, if it's, say, $2 million, we expect them to uphold that NOI being $2 million. And guess what? If it's less, somebody's got to pay. It's really that simple. If somebody tells us that the roofs are in phenomenal condition, and then we send our engineer out there, we do a physical property condition assessment report, and we find out that they got 2 years left, I mean, you know, we're not schnooks here. You have to make sure that you get all of this information out in your due diligence process, because if a story is being painted different than the actual scenario, somebody's got to pay. So we work off that first original number, and then we kind of re-engineer backwards.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. So, I mean, speaking of the due diligence process, Chris, I'll ask you, and I'll let you dive into it. When do you start your due diligence process? What does that look like? When does that actually begin for you guys once you've identified your property?
Well, the due diligence process starts even before we have a deal under contract. But, You know, if you're saying the former due diligence will be, you know, as soon as we make a down payment, you know, on the property, we put up the upfront money, and then usually within a certain period of time, typically 72 hours, all of the actual due diligence in which we start to underwrite the deal has to be released to us pursuant to the contract that we signed.
Yeah, and what Chris is, when he says down payment, he means your earnest money to ultimately bring consideration to the contract. And, you know, there's a couple ways to do it, right? Sometimes what we'll do is you can sign an access agreement and get all the due diligence information prior to even signing a contract. Sometimes it's upon both parties, seller and buyer, executing a contract. There's different ways to skin the cat. Typically for us, though, the due diligence clock doesn't start until we have all of the material information so that we can start going through it.
Okay. So, I mean, Chris, you kind of touched on it a little bit, and then Tony, you also mentioned it. Are you guys doing your due diligence, maybe not formally, but somewhat informally, even before putting in an offer? Are you kind of looking at an area of a property, looking at demos?
You have to, because even before you can put an offer on a property, you have to make sure that that property is viable. You have to make sure that the area is well. I mean, what we look at as a company, you know, being a private equity company, we don't say to ourselves, hey, how much money can we make? We say, how, when, and what will happen for us to lose? So, of course, due diligence has to start immediately when you start looking at a property. But the formal due diligence to make sure that the numbers or the income stream that you're buying is accurate starts, you know, after we officially get a property under contract.
Yeah, and when you're on the acquisition hunt, I mean, you have a business plan or an acquisition plan that you're targeting certain types of assets, certain types of areas, product types, value add, core, whatever you're going after. I don't really consider that due diligence. That's more on the acquisition front. Uh-huh. But what we're talking about here is, you know, formal due diligence. And, you know, at the end of the day, we try to start feeding out information before we even go to contract. We want to pull in as much information as possible, as fast as possible, and get the ball rolling.
Yeah, sure. So speaking of information then, what type of information do you look for from the brokers, from the owners? What specifically are you asking for to, you know, to reassure yourself and everything else that the underwriting you did based on their numbers is accurate? What kind of information do you want from them?
Again, even when a seller is providing information in a formal due diligence period, you still got to take everything that you see with a grain of salt. So it's not some, I mean, we're getting all the information everybody knows, right? You want to do a physical condition report to make sure that the property is structurally sound, the roofs are good, the big operating systems, HVAC, pavement, the whole nine yards is in good working order.
The leases.
Then we step into the leases, which is really, you know, we have a guy that all he does is comb through leases. And leases really probably are the most cumbersome thing to handle in due diligence a lot of times, because you're dealing sometimes multi-hundred page documents, a million different clauses. You know, some of these tenants, they do short, you know, you might see one lease might be 6-7 pages, and then you look at a big national tenant who's on a 30-year deal and they're 300-400 pages, you know. So the leases are a huge thing. Then you got to look at the financials. You know, you have to audit those financials. You don't just take it out of some guy's, you know, accounting software and go, oh, okay, looks good. You then need to audit those to make sure that the net operating income matches up with the leases, the income, and then you have to verify all the expenses. So it really is a cumbersome process. What I'll say, though, is that we can typically get a lot of our due diligence done, you know, in a week, sometimes 2 weeks. What really holds up the process, guys, and I think you'll agree, is, you know, the third-party reports. You know, you're not going to get a formal phase one environmental study done in 1 week. I mean, you can rush it, but, you know, a lot of times that can take, you know, 21 days or more. Same thing with the physical. You send our engineer might go out there, but we might want to get a formal report done. You know, that could take a little bit longer. So the third-party stuff kind of can last a little bit longer. And based on the asset, how many tenants, et cetera, you know, ultimately determines how fast you can get your stuff done.
Yeah, that's a good point. So then, Chris, I mean, how long do you guys typically like to allot yourself to go through this process then? Because like Tony said, you know, a lot of stuff you're going to be doing, maybe it's a 2 week span, you get all the information, you get the, you know, what you need done, but then you're kind of waiting on third party people, right? Getting things back to you. So how long do you want to, you know, contractually speaking, have your due diligence drawn out for?
Well, it's on a deal by deal basis, but we're typically looking at anywhere between 30 to 45 days is usually what we have written in the contract. But again, you know, as you go along, as issues happen, or if you see certain types of language in leases, or if, you know, you go through the physical condition property report and there are issues, typically what happens is, you know, we'll write back through our attorney to the seller's attorney and figure out a way to possibly extend due diligence. So typically 30, 45 days, barring that there are no issues, but this is real estate. A lot of times there are issues, and And sometimes we're forced to extend due diligence because at the end of the day, we don't want our money to go hard unless we're 100% sure that we're buying exactly what we're buying. And that goes not only from, you know, auditing all of the leases, but the physical as well, which, you know, can be very costly, at least in our space when you're dealing with, you know, large institutional projects.
I think that the answer to that question is we want as long as humanly possible. Real estate is all about control. And when we talk about a due diligence period, because I don't think we've even really said this, what we're talking about is a period of time where we can cancel the contract for any reason, but still have the ability to purchase the property. So it's a very powerful position to be in, is to get control of a property and then be able to say, you know what, no, we don't like it, we're out, right? It's a position that you want to put yourself into. But really, we want to have as long as humanly possible. We've closed on deals inside of due diligence periods many times. So we want to have as much time as possible because it gives us a little bit more hand, gives us a little bit more control. And that's really what real estate it comes down to, is shifting control from somebody else's favor into ours.
Sure. No, it's a good point, because when you're going through the process, you want to be able to control the process, right? You don't want it to be in somebody else's hands. So to that point then, I mean, if you're not getting the information you're requesting, or maybe there's more information outstanding, you know, the broker, the owner's slow to get back to you, How do you kind of, you know, nudge them along, or how do you make sure you get the information you're asking for when it's not being as readily supplied as you originally hoped?
It's a great question, because especially with mom and pop guys that you're buying from time to time, you come across this. We specifically write in our contract, and this is the small nuance of being successful and not being successful. There's a million little legal points like this that I'm talking about that can ultimately tip the scales in your favor. When we write, you know, in our contracts, as far as the due diligence period is concerned, we don't start due diligence until 100% of the information that we have requested is given to us. And if these guys are late, we don't start the due diligence period until they've given us that item. You know, it's really that simple. And everybody acknowledges, okay, here's the start of due diligence period. If they don't give it to us, you know, we can't come off handcuffed. There's millions and millions of dollars on the line here. And if we don't have all the information and the time that we need, you know, they can go Mickey Mouse on some other buyer. You got to have everything you need to make the decision and move forward.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is the big leagues. If we don't get any of the information that we don't, you know, we're not going to continue to, you know, start the clock. We have to be able to have all the information in front of us in order for us to be able to conduct due diligence. And when you're playing in our field, you know, that's a given.
And a lot of times there's a lender involved. So they're going to have their own unique set of needs as well. So, you know, you got to be able to take all that into account. Typically, the lenders are slower than we are. Like I said, we can get our crew on it pretty quickly and get the lion's share of the stuff done, you know, in a few days sometimes. But ultimately, when there's a lender involved, you need a little bit more time. A lot of these deals are done without financing contingencies. So in that 30 to 45 days, if any, you know, weenies are being hidden, is, you know, what one guy used on a deal, we got to make sure that we can pull them out for our lender, so to speak.
Now, with all the real estate you've looked at, right, and I know you guys looked at hundreds of deals, you've gone through the process countless times. Can you give me an example of a time you're going through due diligence, something doesn't add up, something's not, you know, the information's not as accurate? How do you handle that situation? What is it that you do when you got a piece of information that's either, you know, misrepresented or it's just outright false, you know, from what you initially thought?
Well, again, as I said before earlier in this, you're buying an income stream. So if there's anything that we uncover in due diligence, whether it's physical, whether it's lease, whether it, you know, there was a misrepresentation on the OM, we're getting an income stream, a percentage on our investment, and we want to make sure at all costs we continue to make that percentage that we thought we were going to make before we even put an offer on the deal. So if there were numbers that were misrepresented, we're going to retrade or get a reduction in price or a credit at closing, whatever you want to call it, that will make sure that we're signing up for what we originally signed up for. So if we have a roof that costs $1 million, well, they're going to have to give us a reduction in price for $1 million, because if we have to come up with an additional $1 million, well, we're not going to make the same percentage return on the income stream that we initially proposed. So that's why that's very important. If there was a lease that had a kick-out clause, I mean, we've had that with a couple of big movie theaters on some of the, you know, big centers that we've done. We have to account for that income because, again, we're expecting to make a specific amount of money for a specific period of time. So we will always retrade. Yeah, Tony, you want to add something?
Yeah, no, I think an income stream we're buying, but it's also a situation to take it to a higher level. You're buying a situation. If somebody can kick out of a lease, you might still have that same income stream, but it's not as strong as if they had, you know, the term that you originally signed up for. So you're buying into a situation. A situation is being presented to you. And if that situation changes, somebody's got to rectify that, or you ultimately have to be able to live with the situation changing and still be able to get in at that price. Now, you know, I think that there's certain spirit of the deal issues that we're not even talking about. You know, stuff does happen inside of due diligence, and stuff always needs to be rectified. But there's a difference, in my opinion, between a material omission, which happens all the time, and, you know, something changes while you're in due diligence.
Can you give an example of what something like that?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about, you know, a kickout clause. We were doing a deal, and it was completely misrepresented in an offering memorandum, which Chris is saying OM. It's where they put all the information on a deal into. And, you know, there was a tenant that had 10 years of term, is the way it was being pitched to us. We uncovered there was only, you know, 7 years of term. That doesn't sound like a lot, but 3 years out of a bigger, I mean, that's a huge deal. So, you know, a lot of some guys, oh, there's no environmental issues, right? And then we get in, there's an environmental issue. So you got to step into these deals with an open mind. This is business. This is the big leagues. Guys are trying to screw and hose, thieve and rob left and right. So you got to have your head screwed on straight. And you have to have a team of people that knows what they're doing, you know, because if you're not conducting and doing this the right way, you know, you could step into a situation, not be able to cover debt service day one. I've seen guys, you know, get in trouble before. So you have to really dig into this stuff. And there's a difference between a picture of what's going on in an offering memorandum and an actual situation. The goal with this due diligence period is to uncover the actual situation and still be able to have value in your deal.
Yeah, because you have to know at, you know, what's the state of mind of the tenant. So what Tony's trying to say, if you have a tenant that's paying you rent every single month, but they have a kickout clause and they're not doing as well as we thought they were, and we were buying the property at a competitive price, but we found out that, you know, one of the anchors is not performing as you know, well as we thought, well, even if they're paying, we might have to retrade because the state of the deal is not the same state of the deal that we thought that we were buying, if that makes sense.
And we've had guys materially misrepresent net operating income. You know, I mean, you know, I've seen net operating income overstated by 50, 60% from time to time. You know, and in those situations, a lot of times you got to walk away because the seller had a certain price in mind, or, you know, or the broker lied. There was a tenant that was supposed to be going in that was in the offering memorandum. They weren't going in. So when a lot of times there's situations that can be rectified inside the due diligence period. What we're talking about retrading the deal. Sometimes, though, there's just a moat, you know, you're just too far apart. And, you know, they're saying the NOI is $3 million. You get in there, it's actually $2.1 million. And a lot of times, you know, you have to take a major hit. The seller would have to take a major haircut, and you're just too far apart. So you got to pull the plug. But you got to know what the actual situation is so you can make that calculated decision.
Well, and I just want to add one other thing, and I don't want to get off topic, but the craziest thing is this. The seller will know that he's selling you something that is not actually what is, but they have a specific price in their mind. They sell themselves their own lie of why they're selling the building at X. And then when we uncover what the truth is and we want to retrade for Y, mentally and socially, they're stuck on X. And
absolutely.
It's the craziest thing.
And it's funny. It's because a lot of times, the saying I heard, buyers are buying on cap rate and sellers are selling on an actual number or price. So trying to rectify those issues when they don't match up sometimes can be very difficult.
Yeah, it's like a play with human psychology, these deals.
And speaking of psychology, and I don't want to go on a tangent here, a lot of times you need to uncover the psychology of the seller when you're buying a property to know what you can get away with. Some guys will drop their drawers. Some guys won't move an inch. Trying to figure out the psychology of the seller and doing it in a covert way is, you know, can add value a lot of times.
So knowing the real story as to why they're selling or what's motivating them to unload the property, basically.
Absolutely right. Anything that you can do to get information in your favor of the psychology of the guy selling it and knowing what state he's in, financial, mentally, physical, whatever, the partnership status of a bunch of guys own it together, a REIT is disposing because they're shifting model, whatever it may be, the closer you can get to the accurate picture of what's going on, not only psychology, but the actual numbers and what's going on at the property, the more ammo you have in your negotiation. The clearer head you can negotiate with.
Because you have to articulate why they need to sell or why they need to, you know, sell to you.
So let me ask you then, because a lot of times, right, especially when you're dealing with these large institutions or REITs or, you know, whoever, big ownership groups, a lot of times you never have direct access to the owner himself, right, or herself. You're dealing with the broker or whoever their representative is. So in the situation where maybe the only communication you're having is through the broker, do you find it more difficult to uncover the true reason behind why they're selling? Is that a hurdle that you kind of have to learn to get over as you become more experienced doing
deals? Well, you get stories, you know. Sometimes you hear a guy selling for this, but he's actually selling for that. Sometimes you actually know what the actual picture is. You know, each deal is a little bit different, you know, but there's been deals when, you know, we heard one story, but it turned out it was something else, and, you know, we still move forward with the transaction. So understanding the guy's psychology is not always crucial to getting a good deal. I was just making the case that the more info you have, the better chance you have of going back to that guy and kind of seeing, well, you know, if a guy doesn't see, look, if a guy's not motivated to sell, and you ask, and you're buying a deal for $30 million, and you ask for $10 million off the purchase price, he's going to tell you to go pound sand, right? Because he doesn't even need to sell it. Sometimes guys that don't need to sell, they won't give you a dollar off the purchase price. Whereas if the guy is incredibly motivated, he's getting a divorce, he's going to go bankrupt if he doesn't sell the property, but he needs the cash injection, that guy's more motivated to make a deal than the aforementioned guy. So, you know, just try to get as much information as you can about the situation.
Yeah, and to answer your question directly, whether it was an institution or an individual or getting in contact with the person who it, really, it's all irrelevant. I've seen it work, you know, buying from a REIT being easier than buying, you know, with a guy that has owned the property for, you know, 50 years. What I can say is this, though. If we're talking about retrading, we're talking about a reduction in price, you want to make sure that you time this reduction at the height of the emotional commitment of the seller. In other words, if you see issues, you want to make sure that, you know, you jot it down and you keep it close to the vest. And, you know, the only suggestion I would make is make sure that you do the retrade at the end of the due diligence period. Why? Because the seller is more apt psychologically and motivated to sell because more time has elapsed.
They're more pregnant in the deal, yeah, is the word that we like to use. And you know what? It gets a kind of a double-edged sword, though, because if you go, as long as you're comfortable walking away, I think what Chris just, and that's what we always are, we'll walk away from a deal. We don't care. You know, and no matter how deep into a deal, you can't go out and spend millions and millions of dollars if the situation is not in your favor. If you're not getting a fair deal, if you don't know that you're going to be successful with the deal, you can't do it. That's why sometimes, you know, at the end of the due diligence period, everybody, including us, including the seller, is more pregnant in the deal, and they're willing to, you know, bend a little bit, so to speak. If you come out in the first week, there's no way we make a deal. But you have to be willing to walk away if you cannot get your price. You have to keep that in mind.
Yeah, I think knowing and remembering that you can walk away and not get married to a deal is super important.
Well, that's right? The difference between success and failure right there. Many people will say the issue, they sell themselves on why they need to own the property, and they say, you know what, I'm good enough to change what was wrong and I'll make it better one day. And it goes back to, you make your money on the buy. You have to make sure that you buy right, and if things happen, you're able to be able to overcome it. And, you know, to do that, circling it all back around, you have to make sure that you're buying the income stream and the state of the property that you originally signed up for.
Yeah, no, it's great advice by both of you guys. And just to remind everybody, don't forget you can check out both Anthony and Chris's bios on our website, fnrpusa.com, as well as all the rest of the information on our firm. Guys, as we kind of wrap this up, I wanted to ask you, you know, really just one more thing, and that's, you know, what advice would you have for someone who maybe isn't as experienced as a group like ours, who's going through the due diligence period? What are some things, you know, what maybe one bit of advice you'd give them to look out for or conduct themselves? Give me something that someone listening now can kind of hang on to next time they're in their due diligence period.
What I'll say is this: do not get involved in a complex, high stakes business or commercial transaction if you do not have the ability to properly underwrite a situation. Everybody wants to be a real estate investor, you know, go out and do deals, and it's a lot of fun and stuff. But so much can go wrong if you're not thorough. I mean, we have an entire staff of people. We might only be working on, many times working on multiple deals at a time, but there's times when we're only working on one deal and we have our entire staff combing through leases. Physical men are down there. Our accountants are running through the numbers and doing their audit. You know, there's just so much that goes into it, and especially these leases. I mean, you know, you're talking about legal jargon, you know, it'll make your head spin. So if you don't underwrite the situation correctly, there's a high probability that you can lose. So if you don't have the staff, if you don't have the resources, if you don't have the time, the thoroughness, and ability to conduct your due diligence on a property correctly, I wouldn't even do the deal. I wouldn't even get into the business, honestly. You know, and look, Chris and I, we've made mistakes in our careers. There's deals where we learn on every single deal how to make it better. But there's just certain things that if you can't go through properly and get the accurate picture of what's going on, you have no business bidding. Go invest with somebody else or don't even get in. You know, it's that simple. And that goes for all investments, but that's just my two cents.
Chris, what about for you?
I would say this. The real estate business, commercial real estate, is a very complex business. And if you have to make sure that you protect yourself, you have to make sure that you conduct all of your due diligence and put all the work up front and don't get emotional. Be prepared to walk away. It's a lot better to lose, you know, let's say $5,000 or $10,000 than, you know, getting your property repossessed because you emotionally committed. And then the last thing is don't ever be afraid to, you know, articulate your points on why you think what you're buying is not the case and ask for a retrade. Remember, these people are selling the property for a reason. It's your job as the buyer to find what that reason is, exploit that reason, and more importantly, when you see deficiencies, have the ability to articulate why you, as the buyer, are the right buyer and that any other buyer that comes in to buy this property is going to have the same issues that you're going to have. And if you articulate that point, usually the people that are selling will agree, barring that they want to sell, and you'll get probably an even better deal than you set out for. Tony and I, we do this unconsciously on every single deal. We wouldn't see it any other way. And I want you guys to be the same way.
That's phenomenal stuff, guys. I tell you what, a lot of great tangible information. Guys, that was conducting thorough due diligence. This is the art of commercial real estate. Thanks for joining us on this episode. We'll have another one out soon. Don't forget to check out the website, fnrpusa.com, for private real estate partnership investments as well as real estate investing. fnrpusa.com. This is the art of commercial real estate.